things as, in the way of introduction. One is that I'm going to do one more thing. We're leaving tomorrow afternoon, but tomorrow morning here at 10:50 in this room, I'm going to read excerpts from three chapters of my memoir that I'm working on. One about my experiences in Selma, not Selma, Middle East, but Selma, Alabama. A second about my experiences. I was the coordinator of the March on Washington for Peace in Vietnam in November 1969. And then an excerpt from my visit to Beirut at a time when the Sabra and Shatila massacres occurred. And so I'm just going to read brief, relatively brief excerpts from those chapters. And that's at 10:50 tomorrow here. Okay, so we're going to stop at 11:40 to see if we can't talk about any questions. The articles that I mentioned yesterday are out here, and in some ways, one of the most important is just this simple list of websites of Jewish, Christian, and Arab American organizations in Washington who work together on this issue. And that, it's sort of fun because you can look at their websites and see how their positions, what they're advocating to our government, are somewhat different or in different language, and oftentimes very close to each other. And I've spoken about that before, and I'll come back to it, but I encourage you to pick that up. Just to quickly review sort of where we ended yesterday, you know, where are we now? Negative or challenging elements of the current situation, a few primary ones. One is the current Israeli government, which is quite hawkish, quite conservative, and the foreign minister quite racist. I mean, he's just explicitly anti-Arab. A man named Lieberman, who comes out of the Russian Jewish immigrants population in Israel. The Prime Minister, Bibi Netanyahu, who comes out of the hawkish side of the Israeli political spectrum. And that's been pretty evident in some of the tensions with the Obama administration that we've witnessed since the two have come to power. So first you have that. That's obviously challenging to peacemaking. When you have a government like that, as compared to, say, a government headed by Yitzhak Rabin, who's committed to making peace. In fact, Netanyahu, until Obama sort of pushed him on it, the U.S. pushed him on it, had never said that he supported a Palestinian state. In fact, he said he opposed the Palestinian state. Well, he gave a speech at Bar-Ilan University in the Negev in which he said it. It was all hedged around, but he did say it. And it's, you know, things like that, you have to say, oh, it's progress, but let's see what happens, you know. Second, if the Israeli government is a problem, the Palestinian governments, plural, is a problem. There are two of them. One in the West Bank, headed by Mahmoud Abbas, primarily a Fatah government. That was the main organization in the PLO coalition. It's the organization that Arafat headed. So you got that government in the West Bank, and then you have the government that's led by Hamas in Gaza. And obviously that's a problem because you're going to negotiate peace with the Palestinians. You want a Palestinian government that can speak both for Palestinians in Gaza and Palestinians in the West Bank. There have been some attempts to try to bring the two factions back together. I think those attempts will probably intensify if there are signs that negotiations are going somewhere. In other words, the interests of certainly Hamas, but also Fatah, to reunite and have one government, I think, intensify with the possibility that there could be an agreement. As long as there's no possibility that negotiations are going anywhere, then keeping their own separate power probably is more important than reuniting. But that's, obviously, that's a challenge to any kind of peacemaking effort. Third, and I mentioned this, I think, a couple of times now, but the sort of feelings among people on both sides of bitter frustration, partly as a result of those hopes that were raised by the Oslo process and then dashed when the Oslo process didn't succeed. So a sense of bitter frustration, loss of hope, lack of trust in the other side. There's the book that I still think, even though it was written a number of years ago, is one of the best books for understanding the conflict. It's by David Shipler, S-H-I-P-L-E-R, and the title is Arabs and Jews. And the subtitle, which relates to this point I've just made about the current situation, Wounded Spirits in a Promised Land. And part of the challenge right now is that wounded spirits of the people on both sides, wounded by the length and intensity of the conflict, all the death and suffering that's gone on, the fears that there are, the lack of sense that the other side really wants peace, etc. So those are some challenges. What are some of the positives in the current situation? First, all evidence that you can gather suggests that most Israelis and most Palestinians want the conflict to be over. They're tired of it. I mean, could they possibly be human beings if they weren't? I mean, you know, this has gone on for 60 years. So want the conflict to end, and that 73%, this is a December poll data, 73% of Israelis and 64% of Palestinians want a two-state solution. That's their idea of what should happen. So that's first hopeful sign. Second hopeful sign. The second is Obama's commitment. Second thing related to people on the ground is that the outline of a solution, such as the Geneva Accord that we looked at yesterday, is widely known. In other words, there were times for most of the history of this conflict, people had their ideas about resolving the conflict, but there wasn't any one outline of what would peace look like if it happened. Now, it's been done. In fact, that's not the only example. Geneva Accord, there's also something called the People's Voice Initiative, which interestingly was written jointly by a man named Sari Nusseibeh, who's president of a Palestinian university in Jerusalem called Al-Quds University, and by the former head of what's the equivalent of the Israeli FBI, called Shin Bet. And that man's name is Ami Ayalon, and they wrote it together. And I heard them speak at the University of Washington about 5 years ago. And when Ami got up to speak, he said, I've been talking with Sari for years. And Sari, who's sitting on the stage, says, yeah, but Ami, most of those years you were interrogating me. Just marvelous. And both of them warmly laughed, you know, and just think about that for a transition in people and attitudes. And here they were speaking in behalf of a joint initiative for peace. So the fact that the outline of a peace agreement is known, it's known in our administration, I think, since Clinton, it's been the element. The elements of that outline are supported by the United States. We don't declare it because there's a reluctance in our policy-making circles to suggest that our ideas are what should make the peace, rather than their ideas. So we hold back. And also, if you're in a negotiating situation, you want the parties to come to it, rather than that you say, this is it. Although, recently, there have been some pressures, both within and outside the Obama administration, saying, you're going to have to say, this is what needs to happen. That would be a shift if the U.S. did that, but some people are urging it, including, by the way, some American Jews. So that's point number two that's positive. And the third point is Obama's commitment, Mitchell being on the job. I think anybody who knows Mitchell has a great respect for him. Obviously, his experience in Northern Ireland is important. And then you have this additional factor of the support from high-level U.S. military people, including General Petraeus. That quotation that I gave out yesterday, very interesting, that Petraeus in his testimony said, you know, that this continuing conflict endangers U.S. interests in the region. U.S. interests, we cannot accomplish our goals in the region, in Afghanistan or Iraq, more widely, as long as this conflict goes on. And our ability to accomplish our goals, which he's saying are positive goals, and we could argue about that, but our ability to have positive influence in the region will be greatly assisted if the U.S. could help resolve this particular conflict. Well, when you have that kind of statement from military people, I think it's quite important because it adds a layer of support that it seems to me it's harder for partisan politics to be played around it. In other words, it's a little tougher for, say, Republicans to attack Obama's efforts for peace if the heads of our military are saying this is important from a military point of view. So it's an interesting added dimension. It also makes Israelis nervous because once that kind of thing is introduced, it sounds as if the U.S. might be willing to be really tougher with Israel because we're not just talking about what's nice or what's good for Palestinians. We're talking about what's good for us, what we need. And if it's what we need, Israel better line up a little bit better with it. And it does. It does make Israelis nervous. That's okay. It's okay. All right, so those are some positive things. and American support. I've spoken about this already. 10 years ago, 15 years ago certainly, Churches for Middle East Peace, which is made up of some 23 representatives of 23 denominations and Catholic orders, representatives of them in a coalition. We, ELCA, is a part of the Churches for Middle East Peace. 10, 15 years ago, Churches for Middle East Peace was viewed in the Jewish community, even in the American Jewish peace community, as somewhat too partisan on the Palestinian side. So there were tensions between American Jewish groups working for peace and Churches for Middle East Peace. Those tensions have almost entirely dissolved. And they've dissolved because both groups, not because one surrendered their idea, but because both groups have moved to come to see a certain common set of things that is best to advocate in order to advocate to our government to do in order to help achieve peace. And in fact, the list now includes that of groups that are in this sort of position: Churches for Middle East Peace, the American Task Force on Palestine, which is a Palestinian-American group of basically professional and business people who meet annually when they have their annual dinner in Washington. Usually 500 or 600 people come. So American Task Force on Palestine, which is Palestinian-American, the Americans for Peace Now, which is Jewish group, and the sort of American partner to Israeli Peace Now, and then fourth, this new lobby, which is identifies itself as pro-Israel, pro-peace, and that's J Street. And they chose the name because, I don't know if you know this, but there is no J Street in Washington. And I can't remember what the reason for that is, but there is no J Street in the alphabet of the streets. And K Street is where all the lobbies are. So there was sort of a play on words. And of course, J also stands for Jewish, et cetera. Anyway, so those groups, and sometimes the Arab American Institute, which is an older Arab American organization, is in that coalition, and the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Recently, for instance, this goes back probably 6 months, there was a letter co-signed by all of those groups. I don't think the Catholic bishops were involved in it, but all of the other groups calling for an end of the siege of Gaza. Very interesting to have Jewish groups. And you know, J Street is a $5 million a year going thing. It's got a huge staff, a large staff, not compared to APEC, but a large staff. And to have them with the churches and the Arab Americans all calling for the same thing about Gaza, very interesting phenomenon. So to me, that's important in terms of positive movement. I've one more element, though, that they're still a little bit more standoffish from these groups, and I think these groups, certainly our Church of Middle East Peace, a little standoffish from them. There are now a growing number of conservative Christian evangelicals who have signed on to letters supporting a two-state solution and supporting the United States' energetic diplomacy to help achieve a two-state solution. So this caricature, I'd say it's a caricature of conservative evangelicals as all being, you know, into end times theology and pro-Israel more than, you know, sort of more Israel than thou sort of positions, very hawkish on Israel and stuff. It's a caricature. It's a reality for a percentage of conservative evangelicals, but it certainly doesn't represent all conservative evangelicals. And at least according to David Neff, who's the editor of Christianity Today, I don't know if you know that magazine, but it's the main main national conservative evangelical magazine. He says 65% of conservative evangelicals support a two-state solution. So that it's actually a minority of conservative evangelicals who are into this end times theology stuff, but they're very loud, they raise a lot of money, and so it seems like that's it in terms of conservative evangelicals. Now, if that's the good news about American public opinion and support, there's some mixed news. Not surprisingly, given the differences and the debates on the ground among Palestinians and Israelis about what to do, there also is some conflict within our different communities and also between our communities about different ways of viewing the conflict and different ways of advocating and acting to end the conflict. For example, in the Jewish community, I mean, it's pretty clear, you've got J Street here and AIPAC here. And AIPAC also includes, oftentimes, American Jewish Committee takes the same positions as AIPAC and other major Jewish organizations, ADL, Anti-Defamation League, take fairly conservative, I would say hawkish positions that they identify as being pro-Israel. You got J Street, which is advocating positions that are very close to churches from the Middle East peace, which they say is pro-Israel. So the pro-Israel is a big debate in the Jewish community. Polls have showed that on some key issues, for example, freezing settlements, most American Jews support that, even though AIPAC doesn't. So even though AIPAC is a louder voice, a more funded voice, the fact is that on some key issues, more American Jews support a J Street type politics rather than an AIPAC type politics. You know, politics, I mean, sometimes popular opinion and where money is don't jive, you know. So that tension is there. And it's an ongoing debate in the Jewish community, and it will be. And if you go on the J Street website, you'll find, though J Street has been careful, and I think wisely so, not to advertise that it's anti-AIPAC or that it's an alternative to AIPAC. It's just stated its positions, which are different than AIPAC, and let the chips fall where they may. I think that's a smart approach rather than, you know, it's sort of like the difference between David just shooting the rock at Goliath's head, and if he hits it, fine. Rather than David coming and saying, I'm going to beat the hell out of you, you stupid giant, you know? I mean, I think it's smarter to do something rather than to advertise that you're going to take care of this giant lobby. So you've got that tension in the Jewish community. Second, in the Arab American and Muslim communities, you also have a tension. I mentioned Arab American Institute and the American Task Force on Palestine. They work in Washington advocating what kind of policy steps should the U.S. make to help move the parties toward peace. You have another group, smaller, quite activist, called AWDA, which is a national network, focused on the return of refugees to their homes, focused on right of return. Well, you can understand from the things I've said that I think people close to negotiations don't believe that can happen, return, in other words, that Palestinians being returned to their homes in Israel. But this is a group that's concerned about that, very emotional, very activist, and does conferences and does speaking tours, et cetera, right of return. So you have that sort of tension in the Arab American Muslim and Muslim community. The other thing about the Muslim community that I assume you know is that most Muslim Americans are not Arabs. More of them are South Asians, Pakistani, Indian, Singaporean, Malaysian, et cetera, Somalian. And so where they fit is not exactly clear. I mean, that's not a matter of tensions with them. It's a matter of this may not be their issue. You know, it may not be their concern. African American Muslims. So that's that community. Then the Christian community, which this is mostly, I think most of us are Christian. What about us? Well, there first is this tension between liberal Protestant denominations, most of them, like the ALCA, and the Catholics, versus the end times Christians. There's that tension. So in a way you could say it's CMEF, Churches for Middle East Peace, versus KUFI, which is the Christians United for Israel. This is the thing headed by the Texas minister, John Hagee. A lot of money there, much more money than Churches for Middle East Peace, I can tell you. And he organized these big trips to Israel and raved for the settlements, raved for Israel, killing the Palestinians. He didn't say killing the Palestinians, but beating the Palestinians, whatever. Just a cheering squad for some of the worst policies that Israel has. So you've got that tension going on in the Christian community. But you have a second tension that's a little more complicated, and that is between Churches for Middle East Peace and Sabeel, or Friends of Sabeel, two American Christian organizations working on this conflict with somewhat different approaches to it. Both say they're for a two-state solution. Churches for Middle East Peace works fairly specifically on policy objectives in Washington that they believe advance toward a two-state solution. Sabeel, at least in some of their materials, and I attended the conference in Seattle, a little bit more ambiguous about it's for two states, but it had a number of speakers that at the conference that were for one state. In other words, not for Israel next to Palestine, but for one state which would have Palestinians and Jews in it and have equal equality. So that's a sort of mixed message sometimes from Sabeel. Second, in terms of strategies, Churches for Middle East Peace works on policy related to the Congress and the administration. Sabeel increasingly has favored what's called the BDS strategy, boycott, divest, sanction. In other words, following, in a way, sort of taking the model from the South Africa struggle against apartheid and applying it to this conflict, what needs to happen is there need to be activities, organized programs that begin to apply pressure on the Israeli government in the way that pressure was applied on the South African government. And so boycotts, the best strategy, and on campuses, this is increasingly on sort of on campuses where there's a real activist pro-Palestinian group or a group of people, this kind of an emphasis has been sort of more appealing recently. And obviously one of the things that helps is the current Israeli government. You know, in other words, the current Israeli government being right-wing oriented, doing what it did in Gaza, it sort of fuels the kind of anger against the Israeli policies and against the Israeli government that gives support to that strategy. So there's a tension there. Let me say in parentheses here, I'm saying this in this class. When I give public talks, I'm very careful about how I talk about this. And I know that CMEP certainly is careful. I think Sabil is too. In other words, they don't want to start a fight with each other. But I think it is important, as we think about what we're going to do, to recognize that there are some differences between the approaches. The third difference in their approach is that, where I've already said, Churches for Middle East Peace works very closely with Americans for Peace Now and J Street, two Jewish organizations working for peace. Sabil tends not to work very closely, and in fact, some of the things that Sabil has said and done have caused real tension with those Jews. In other words, with American Jews who are working very closely with Churches for Middle East Peace on policy changes. And that's complicating, to say the least, because it seems to me, obviously I'm giving away in a certain sense my bias here, I think we need to do all we can to be together about worthwhile things if we're going to have political influence in Washington. And I want to move to that question of why is it important? Well, I'll come back, maybe someone will ask a question about there's a particular document now that's involved in this tension called the Kairos document, which some of you may have read or at least heard about. It's a document authored and signed by a number of Palestinian Christian leaders. Bishop Yunan at first signed on to it and then withdrew his name, and that's complicated in terms of both his own judgment about what was useful and Israeli pressure on him when he signed on to it. He was the only head of a denomination on the ground that signed on to it. Put himself by doing that in a vulnerable position with the Israeli government. So it's partly that, but it's also partly, I think, Munib's own sense of what is helpful. The tension, I'll just characterize it this way. The tension, I mean, people, various church bodies have said, at least gone this far, congregations should study the Kairos document by the Palestinian Christians. It's a cry for help from Palestinian Christians. And I believe very much we Christians here should respond to the cry for help from Palestinian Christians. So a number of denominations have said, I think probably ELCA is, it's good to study that document, congregation. They don't say, okay, we're in favor of it, we endorse it wholeheartedly, but study it, look at it. I think it's a good thing. My problem is that I think how we respond to their cry for help has to be done thoughtfully and carefully in our context. In other words, our responding positively to their cry for help is not as simple a matter as simply echoing what they're saying, but rather figuring out what we ought to say in our American political context that helps respond to their cry for help, that advocates things with our own government that could be helpful to them. We can come back to that. It's complex, it's sensitive. Obviously, it's sensitive. I mean, here are Palestinian Christians, you know, writing a document. They send it here. They send people over to speak about it. How do we respond? And I can get into some of the issues in the document that complicate the discussion, but I'm going to not do that. What I want to say briefly is, why do I think it's important to work together? It's fairly simple from my experience. First is that I think we're commanded to work together for peace by our faith. And I was fascinated in 1985, 6, 7, when I was organizing the U.S. Interreligious Committee and went to high level, in that case it was Herb Chilstrom for the Lutherans, but I went to the head of Reform, Conservative, and Reconstructionist Jews, the head of the Council of Mosques, the head of a number of other Protestant denominations, and I was impressed and surprised when I asked them. I said, look, what I'm talking about here is forming an interreligious committee for peace between Arab states, Israel and Palestinians, they said, that's important, we should do that. They didn't even ask me, well, what's the politics of it? You know, what's your statement? Because we hadn't made one yet. We hadn't agreed on one yet. They said yes. And why did they say yes? A number of them said, I have to do that. I have to be involved in that. In other words, on a faith basis, I have to say yes to you. I may get out later on, you know, but initially it's a faith, it's a matter of faith. We need to work together for peace. I remember a Palestinian who was 16 years old in a village by the name of Deir Yassin, which some of you may know if you know the history of this conflict. In 1948, Begin's faction carried out a massacre in the village. Dawood was there. He was 16 years old. A number of his family was killed. He and his mother escaped to Jordan. When I went to see him, he was then the head of the Council of Mosques. He said, Ronald, I will work with you. It will be hard for me, but I will work with you. And I said, well, you mean it'll be hard because you're Palestinian? He said, no, what you don't know is I'm from Deir Yassin. And I almost like fell off the chair. Here I am, a white Western American Christian, asking some guy who was 16 in Deir Yassin when he saw his family massacred by Jews, asking him to work with Jews for peace. And he could see I was very upset. I said, oh my God, I didn't know that. He got up from his desk, walked around the desk, put his hand on my shoulder and said, Ronald, it's okay. I am a Muslim and I know I should work with Jews and Christians for peace. That's a kind of testimony that I heard again and again. So it's first a matter of faith. Second, I think, from my experience, to really understand the situation in this conflict at any point, it's important that we are in conversation with people who feel attached to the conflict in some other way than we are. So if one of the ways we're attached to the conflict is that we're Lutheran, and we know there are Palestinian Lutherans on the ground, and we're trying to listen to them and respond to them, I think it's important that we also relate to Americans who are Jews who connect mainly with Israel. So that as we're seeking to understand the events that are happening, we're listening to people who feel it, see it, experience it, from the different sides. And a very good example is if you know anything about what Palestinians have been going through in Gaza, if you're not sympathetic, you're dead. I mean, dead in the sense your heart, your mind, your spirit is dead because it's terrible. But if you talk to Jews, it's doubtless they will raise something about the rockets that were coming into Israel. And the situation in Gaza is so bad, sometimes it's possible to look at that and not pay any attention to the rockets. But if you're in conversation with Jews, my guess is you'll hear about the rockets and you'll say, oh yes, of course, the rockets, you know, that's stuff. What I'm saying is that to understand the situation adequately, which is important in figuring out what it's best to advocate, it's important to have these connections so that we're hearing and experiencing the conflict from the different sides. And that doesn't mean it's all equal and Israeli suffering. It just has to do with understanding the conflict. And obviously, people experience conflicts from the side that they're on. You know, that's the way we live. All right, and the third reason is I think that if we work together, we are likely to have more political effectiveness and impact with Congress or the administration than if we work separately. I remember in 1989, which was the U.S. Interreligious Committee organized the first national interfaith convocation and congressional visitation for peace in the Middle East, 1989, March. And the last day was people going in interfaith delegations to visit their members of Congress. And when they came back, so by the way, what's the Lutheran church on Capitol Hill? I can't think of the name of it. But when we came back to the Lutheran church to sort of debrief, a number of people said that they had this incredible experience meeting with Congress, where the member of Congress was totally shocked that he or she was being visited by an interfaith delegation that had Jews, Christians, and Muslims in it, advocating the same things. Because they were much more used to people coming in and advocating from one side or the other side, and here was a group that was advocating together a common stance. So I think it's true that we probably would be more politically effective if we worked together. Well, last thing here is I think we're in a time of testing the two-state solution. I mean, if it's not soon, it may be never. And never doesn't mean some other peace. It means continuing violence and conflict. Now, it's easy to say, well, if there's not two states, then maybe it'll be one state. The problem with that is the whole purpose, or not the whole purpose, but a major purpose of Israel, from a Jewish point of view, is to have a state where Jews are in the majority. Because, as they would say, and you know, some of their humorists would say it in a funny way, say, you know, look, we've done the minority bit, you know? And it didn't work out so well. We need a state where we're in a majority. We also need it because it's a certain fulfillment of Jewish national aspirations and identity. And I remember Jews who have gone to the Middle East and they say, my God, Friday night and Saturday is the Sabbath here. You know? As compared to Sunday, Sunday, Sunday. Or if you were in a Muslim country, Friday, Friday, Friday. You know? So I think we're in a time where the two-state idea is either going to happen within the next few years, or it may be out of the question, partly because the settlements continue to expand, and as they continue to expand, the possibility of a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza gets less and less. And if they expand and there's no settlement, there will be more Palestinian violence. I mean, anybody who thinks that the situation, it may be calm for a while, but it's going to stay calm, hasn't read the history. It's going to blow up one place or another. Hezbollah is going to blow it up. Hamas is going to blow it up. Iran's going to, I mean, you know, the Israelis are going to blow it up. Somebody's going to, it's going to happen. It's going to explode. So we're in a time of testing, and therefore there's a sense of urgency that we get it done. I remember visiting, Carol and I went to see a man by the name of Saad Erekat, who now you'll see in the news every time there's mention of Palestinian negotiators, because he's the chief negotiator for the Palestinian Authority in behalf of Mahmoud Abbas. Saad Erekat. He was then the vice president of An-Najm University in Nablus. And when we went to see him, he said, before we talk about the current situation, I have to tell you about a terrible dream I had. This dream. He said, yeah, he said, I woke up sweating. He said, I woke up from a dream where apparently the two-state solution had failed, and I was working for equal rights in Israel. This is a Palestinian city. And he said, I woke up sweating and nervous. He said, my God. And then he said, unless we get a two-state solution, that's what's going to happen. That people like me are going to wind up working. And he said, I don't want to. We want a Palestinian state. Well, this was quite a long time ago, you know. This was like 1984. So a lot of time has passed. And then you had, very recently, in 2007, Ehud Olmert, who was the prime minister of Israel, no longer, but was prime minister, and a fairly hawkish guy himself, saying at the end of the Annapolis conference, if the two-state idea doesn't happen, Israel is finished. Meaning, Israel cannot survive as a Jewish or a democratic state if there's not a Palestinian state next to it. So there is a sense of urgency, a sense of we're in the end game of this conflict in terms of if it's going to be ended peacefully, the next 2 or 3 years are crucial. And if it's not ended peacefully, it's not going to end. It's going to go on in some way, boiling. And if it keeps boiling, the negative effects of this conflict, which General Petraeus has spoken about, which Baker Hamilton spoke about, the negative effects of this conflict in terms of a source of fuel for extremism in the Middle East and terrorism will continue to be supplied. And that should make us nervous too. I mean, that should give us some energies to work on this as well, because I think there's no doubt, while there are many causes of extremism and terrorism in the Middle East, this is one of them. And extremist groups play on the Palestinian issue and the Palestinian suffering and the Palestinian lack of a state in order to drum up support for their particular politics and their particular actions. So that also is part of what the motivation, the urgency in the current situation. So stop there before 11:40, or we're almost there anyway. What questions did any of you have that didn't really get discussed yet?
Would you comment on the with Iran?
Yeah, good. Yeah. Well, the first thing to say is, you know, we have a way in this country, I mean, maybe other people have it, but I think we're particularly good, if it's good, we're particularly good at it, that when something changes, we like there was a change in government and we have now a new president in Iran, we think that that is Iran, the new president is Iran. The new president is very different from the last elected president. The last elected president in Iran was a man named Khatami. He favored dialogue with the West. He supported Palestinians making peace with Israel and said as soon as they do, Iran will support this. This was the last elected president in Iran. So I say that just to say that we ought to keep our minds a little bit agile about Iranians and look at the recent government election. Look at, I mean, the the tremendous outpouring of opposition there was by Iranians to the election of this government, which they said was fraudulent, at great risk, I mean, and loss of life of many Iranians. So, first thing to say about Iran is that Iran is not to be summed up in the current president's view. There are different Iranian views and different Iranian tendencies. Second thing to say is that, obviously, two things. Iran is active in supporting radical Islamic groups, both in Lebanon and in Gaza, Hezbollah in Lebanon and Hamas in Gaza. And it does that because it sees those groups' politics as aligned with its Islamic views. And it is supplying those groups with weapons, including, if the reports are true, some more advanced, therefore one could say smarter, rockets, both in Hezbollah, to Hezbollah and Gaza, which means that the next round of fighting between Israel and either of those parties may be worse for Israel than the last round. That is to say, the rockets may be able to hit some urban targets or targets where there are more people and therefore do more damage. So that's to say, and obviously, if the conflict were resolved, the potential for Iran doing that is much less, obviously. Palestinians don't need rockets if there's a peace agreement. Third thing to say on the nuclear issue is, you know, for how long have we known if the parties have nuclear weapons that other parties will want them? Pretty basic stuff, you know? I went to Memphis to work in a black church in 1962. A month after I got there, the Cuban Missile Crisis occurred. You remember that? The Russians, the Soviet Union, supplied Cuba with missiles that could reach the United States. The United States was furious. John F. Kennedy imposed a blockade, and insisted that the rockets be taken back out. Now, several months earlier, the United States had provided similar rockets in Turkey, based in Turkey, aimed at the Soviet Union. The deal that was reached secretly was that the U.S. would pull its rockets out of Turkey if the Russians pulled their rockets out of Cuba. But the deal was never publicized because the politics of the Kennedy administration at the time and media support, popular support, was Kennedy being tough was what did it. But it wasn't. It was negotiating a deal that did it. All I'm saying about that is positively, you know, that's sort of the way things can get done. That deals are worked out. And what I'm saying negatively is that critically, don't we understand that if one party in a conflict has nuclear weapons, that other parties in the conflict are going to want them and try to get them? And so the fact that Israel, though it says, it makes no comment about whether it has nuclear weapons or not, it has nuclear weapons. And so, naturally, at some point, Arab countries, or Iran in this case, if they have any kind of capacity, they're going to want to get nuclear weapons. Now, what the Arabs have said for years is, we should, and they've tried to do things in the UN about this, there should be a nuclear-free zone in the Middle East. Well, if the only party that has nuclear weapons in the Middle East is Israel, what does a nuclear-free zone mean? You understand this being an Arab position, right? I mean, it has a certain moral appeal, nuclear-free zone. The problem is that Israel's the only one that's got it. So what it means is Israel should get rid of the nuclear weapons. My view about this, and I've talked with some American Jewish religious leaders who are concerned about getting rid of nuclear weapons, period. Two points. One is, and it's basic, the U.S. has to be committed to zero nuclear weapons in its own, our own nuclear weapons. And it has to get the Soviet Union. But Obama has said more about this than any recent president. Move toward zero nuclear weapons and this agreement with the Russians to reduce our stock. I wish they had said zero nuclear weapons and here's the timetable that will accomplish it, you know? So that's number one. Without that kind of commitment, the game goes on. Inevitably, the game goes on. Second, another reason for resolving the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian conflict is in the context of a peace treaty that resolves that conflict, the issue of Israel having nuclear weapons is a very different issue than in the context of an ongoing conflict. That is to say, once this conflict is resolved, the issue of a nuclear weapons-free zone, Israel giving up its nuclear weapons, in exchange for Iran not developing its nuclear weapons, that becomes a ball game that you can operate in. As long as there is this conflict, Arab-Israeli conflict, then the idea of getting Israel to give up its nuclear weapons, I think, is maybe a nice idea, but it's not going to happen. Not going to happen. So that's now. I think the other thing I'd say about Iran, I mean, I think Obama is right that diplomacy has to be the main way to go about that. And I think that recently this thing with Brazil and Turkey, I wish it had been done better. That is done better in the sense that that the U.S. and the European countries that are now involved in the support of sanctions that are on Iran had worked more closely with Brazil and Turkey to have them play a role that would in fact satisfy the goal of enough limitation on Iran's capacity that you wouldn't have to go to sanctions. I think it was messed up, the way that all happened. Maybe Turkey and Brazil were part of the reason it was messed up. Who knows? Obviously, Iran was looking for an agreement with Brazil and Turkey that would get around the European pressures. So it's complex, but I would say diplomacy is still the main way, and I was glad to hear Gates, Secretary of Defense Gates, who I have great respect for, saying he didn't talk about the military option. I mean, they never say the military option is off the table. That's sort of standard language. But he talked about diplomacy, and he talked about sanctions, those being the ways to work. And I think that's right. I think that's we need to support that. You know, there are elements in our country, the so-called neoconservatives, who are pumping up the idea of war with Iran. War with Iran. And I think it's a familiar argument because they did the Iraq thing for us. The neocons did. I mean, that was their hey, it really worked, and they got the country. Well, they got the country. They and the administration got the country to war with Iraq. Go ahead, back there. Yeah.
So, can you talk a little bit about faith and this conflict from a Muslim point of view? So we understand in the Christian tradition we have some end times folks and so on. We understand the Zionist point of view. I think I don't understand, or I don't think I've read or heard much talk about the various faith traditions within the Muslim community, whether Shias or Sunnis or any of the sects. Whether this land issue is a land and home issue, is it a faith issue too, as it is with some of the other religious traditions?
Well, it's interesting. I referred before to this idea that in Islamic teaching of what they said, there is the land of Islam and the land of sort of non-Islam, of the sort of heathens, if you will. It's a traditional concept. It's a concept that really has not played much of a role in the Israeli-Palestinian or Arab-Israeli conflict, partly because the Arab states that we're talking about in this case, Egypt, Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, are not Islamic states in anywhere near the sense that, say, Iran is. So that Islamic scholars are not the ruling body in any of those countries. Egypt says it's an Islamic state, and it has Islamic scholars, but they're not the ruling council of Egypt. And as is true, that is true for Jordan, that is true for Syria, even more so for Syria, it's true for Lebanon. So first of all, there's no, and it's true, been true of the Palestinian movement. Now, Hamas introduces a new element. I mean, it's obviously clearly more religiously based. It uses more religious arguments. It's part of the basis for their rejection of Israel in their what do you call it, their charter or their covenant, the Hamas covenant. And by the way, it's worth reading it because, I mean, I read it as a non-Jew and it made me nervous. If you read it as a Jew, it'll make you more nervous because of the religious coupled with the political and the non-acceptance of Judaism and Islam being the answer and get rid of Israel and so forth. Now, that doesn't mean all Hamas people believe that. So it is more of a factor that's been brought into the conflict by Islam, and on the Israeli side, it's that kind of relationship between faith and politics is relatively, it's a percentage of Israeli politics, but a relatively small percentage, maybe 15, 20%, depending on the issue, that the idea that God gave us this land and this land is ours and that's all you need to know, there's that in Israel. It's never been the majority, it's not close to a majority, it's never been the guiding thinking of the political main political establishment in Israel. For Hamas, it is, although Hamas has had, you know, any serious political movement can relate to its ideology, but it also has to relate to its constituency, to the people that it wants to support. So, for example, when the Palestinians held elections in 1996, Hamas took the position the Oslo Agreement was illegitimate. There should be no negotiations with Israel. These elections held as part of the Oslo process are illegitimate. All Palestinians should boycott these elections. The problem was that 85% of the Palestinians in Gaza wanted to vote. And they did vote. Palestinians in Gaza voted in the Palestinian elections. So Hamas had to find a way with those ideological clear positions to sort of back up a little, you know. Not because its ideology changed, it didn't change its ideology, but it was trying to relate to its supporters. It was trying to keep its supporters its supporters. So I think that will happen. Well, there's other signs of it. You know, Hamas says don't negotiate with Israel. The fact is, Hamas has been, through mediators, whatever, negotiating with Israel about prisoner releases. Hamas agreed to a ceasefire with Israel that was held up. This last terrible war that happened was happened at the end when a ceasefire expired. I fault the United States for not sending Rice or somebody out there to try to keep the ceasefire in place. But in any case, here's Hamas who says, we never negotiated with the Jewish entity, with the blah, 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 but they negotiated a ceasefire. So that, well, I guess what I'm saying is that certain practical realities make even rigid ideological formations like Hamas bend some. And that's encouraging to me. I mean, if they didn't bend, two things. One, they're even more extreme than I think they are. That is, they don't even have elements in their leadership that are practical. And second, my guess is they'd get smaller. Because people who support them would want bending. If bending gets a ceasefire, bend a little, you know? I don't know if that's helpful or not. It's the beginning of a bigger discussion. Religion, this has never been fundamentally a religious conflict. That's the other thing that I think is basic to say. It's always been a conflict between two tribes, the Jewish tribe and the Palestinian tribe, or the Jewish national movement and the Palestinian national political movement. And those movements have never primarily been defined by religion. Religion has been an element in them on both sides. But never have they been religious nationalist movements. Yeah.
Has the expansion of settlements always simply been an effort, or mostly simply been an effort to prevent a two-state solution? And the second part of the question is, what kind of pressure can either church groups or we put on our government to help continue the moratorium that ends, I think you said,
no, September? Good. First, I don't know that it's been to prevent a two-state solution. There have been three motivations. One is, initially, after the 67 war, Israeli, and it was a labor government, not a Likud government, so it was somewhat more liberal, dovish, and less attached to religious parties. The labor government decided that for security reasons, it would put a few settlements into the West Bank, particularly in high ground places, where it would give them Israelis an advantage if Jordan were to attack again. So there was a security rationale for it. Now, you know, many people argue, and I think they're right, that under international law, when you occupy a territory in a war, you're not allowed to change what happens in that territory. I mean, obviously you change it because you occupy it, but you can't move people in and out because that suggests that you're going to stay there. So I think that international law is on the side of you shouldn't put settlements. But so first was security. Second, as I said, when the 67 war ended and Israel had won it, there was a sense of euphoria among Israelis. My God, God is really, you know, this land really is being given to us by God. We won the war even though we expected to be defeated, da 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 da. And so there was a sense of greater Israel, of expanding into those territories. It was helped by the fact that the Arabs weren't ready to negotiate any kind of an end to the conflict. I mean, if the Arabs had said at the end of the 67 war, I think there are good reasons why they didn't, or at least reasonable reasons, if they had said, okay, we're ready to negotiate peace with you in exchange for you giving back the territories, that would have created quite a dynamic, but there was nothing like that coming from the Arabs. And in fact, that 67, it wasn't until 88 that the PLO agreed to that kind of proposition. It wasn't until 78 that Egypt agreed to that kind of an idea. Up until then, what they were saying is no to Israel. So the Israelis said, you know, greater Israel. And then there was a religion, and economically, they were able to build settlements in the West Bank, maybe with Palestinian labor, you know, that were cheaper. And so people who worked in Tel Aviv, because the distances are all very small on this map, they could live in a settlement that maybe was 10, 15, 20 miles further from Tel Aviv. But what did that mean? If you have a car, you get to work, and you're going to have cheaper rent. Then the third reason was there was a religious element among the Israelis that saw this really as God's will. And if you look at the settler population, Jewish settlers, you'll find that most of them are fairly sort of pragmatic, and many of them would be prepared to move back into Israel if they were offered a little economic incentive. Some, a small percentage, but maybe 20%, something like that, are religious, strong religious, and the army may have to remove them. And just as in Gaza, there was a fear that there would be fighting between the settlers being removed and the army removing them. It didn't happen. There was some, but minimal. There's more of that fear in the West Bank, partly because if you know your Bible, the West Bank is Judea and Samaria. And in fact, some Jews, Israeli Jews, call it that. They don't call it the West Bank. They call it Judea and Samaria. Now, the Palestinians have sometimes joked saying, okay, listen, we'll give you Judea and Samaria. We'll take the coast. Israelis don't respond to that. So, something about the settlements, yeah. Yeah?
I think you commented on the smallness.
Yes.
Unless you have been there.
Yes.
It's hard to appreciate the smallness.
Yeah, we're talking small. We're talking about the whole distance from the Jordan River to the sea, to where Tel Aviv is, probably 50 miles. So, less than an hour's drive without traffic. The distance from where the West Bank is the widest, say up here or here, is maybe as little as 20 miles, 15 miles, whatever, small. Then these distances also are not great. So the Israelis feared that Jordan, with help from Iraq, might invade. So there's nervousness because of the narrowness of the thing. Obviously, the Palestinians also will have a small part. And something to remember is that when the Palestinians get their state, West Bank and Gaza, it represents approximately 24-25% of all of Palestine. So from their point of view, it's a radical compromise, since they believe that all of that was Palestinian.
And how many people are we talking about that would be in
there? Well, it's interesting. You're talking about, between the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, a population something close to the Israeli population of Jews. And the Israeli population now is up, I think, 6 million, and 20% of that 6 million are Arab citizens or Palestinian citizens of Israel. But the size of the numbers of Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank is one of the reasons why people are saying, if this situation stays the same and Israel keeps control of all this, there's either definitely then an apartheid situation if the Palestinians don't get a vote, and if the Palestinians get a vote, there's no Jewish state. And by the way, that is what has driven or pushed conservative Israelis, who would like to hold on to the same thing, to say, we'll go for two states.
Yeah.
In other words, that's why of Bibi Netanyahu, not just because Barak pressured him, but also he sees the situation. Now, by the way, Peace Now has been saying that since it was formed at the end of the 70s, that if we keep this territory, it's either apartheid, it's either not democratic state or not a Jewish state. But this is often the case with peace movements, that they say things that you know, are actually true. And they said them for many years, and then eventually, parties in power start to say them too. If we're lucky, that happens. If we're lucky. So I don't know. We're about over. I wanted to say one more, that if some of you are around tomorrow, and I welcome you here, and I welcome some feedback for you, because I'm still working on my memoir, and we'd love to get some reactions from people as to how it reads or how it hears, how you hear it. Because I'm going to read it, and that's different than you're reading it. But back here at 10:50 tomorrow morning. So thank you.